Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 344 for August 26 of 2016. The supercharger goes electric. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Well, Mr. Vasilash, here we find ourselves yet again doing an episode of
Autoline. It's been a long time. We did it in Traverse City, and then last week I was in Virginia driving the new Kia Cadenza, which I want to talk about later. And,
good.
So finally getting back here, back in the saddle.
Cool. Good. No, it's great to have you back in the studio. It's good to be here. I just flew in from New York. I mean, I haven't even been in here an hour yet. And we got to let everybody know, Dave Zoya from Ward's Auto is with us.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. So I'm sure you've got some good cars to talk about later in the show as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. And so our special guest, we got to let everyone in the studio or in the audience know, is Matty Vint. He's the director of powertrain research and development for North America for the supplier Valeo. And Matty, it's good to have you here on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
And you brought a car in, and this is what we always like. Now, it's a Lincoln MKZ. But under the hood is something very different that Lincoln does not yet sell, and that's, of course, this e-supercharger. So tell us what this is all about.
Okay, so Valeo makes a range of powertrain products. Our main focus is on fuel economy. Now, fuel economy itself is a tough sell sometimes, so it's always nice to bring in fun to drive with fuel economy, and we believe the electric supercharger does exactly that. So this demonstrator vehicle is one way of showing the capabilities of electric supercharger, and there are many, many ways of using it, more than what we have in this one vehicle. But, you know, I can talk about it on PowerPoints as much as I like, but the proof of the pudding, right, is when,
driving.
When actually having in a vehicle.
Okay, so now we got to ask Gary, because Gary got a chance to take the car out and drive it. Mm-hmm. So what do you think?
So when we got into the supercharger, now it operates at a lower RPM, right?
It runs at the lower engine RPM.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But when it kicked on, it was very discernible. I mean, it was very nice performance.
But it wasn't like turbochargers of old, which were like on-off switches?
Not really, I wouldn't say. But so this is a turbocharged engine as well, right?
It is, yes. So
right.
It's a 2-liter EcoBoost engine.
Right.
It, you know, obviously it has a turbocharger. And we think turbochargers are still the way of the future. I mean, downsizing engine is the future. And using turbochargers extracts that energy from the enthalpy from the exhaust. And that's the most efficient way of getting the energy. But turbochargers have issues, right? Turbo lag. I mean, historically, there's always been turbo lag. And the more you downsize an engine, the greater the... Because you need to go to a bigger turbocharger because you have to have the same performance. I mean, customers always expect the same, you know, torque at the rear wheels for drivability. In fact, they want more year by year. So as you go to a smaller engine, you increase the boost pressure. That means a bigger turbocharger, which means more turbo lag. Also means you lose out on torque at lower RPM, which is very important because the other trend in the industry is downspeeding. That is running, you know, in higher gears as often as possible. So you get more in the sweet spot for the engine, the lower brake-specific fuel consumption. So the electric supercharger provides that. Now, this vehicle, it's a demonstrator vehicle. It's not how I would approach it if I was an OEM. With an OEM, I'd actually put a larger turbocharger in and then use the electric supercharger. But again, we're obviously cost-constrained. So we chose to use the existing EcoBoost 2-litre engine with turbocharger and then put in the electric supercharger. Again, to get rid of the turbo lag, provide the extra torque. Now, this one puts in about an extra up to 1.4 bars extra in terms of boost. So that's, I'm not sure what that is in PSI. I guess it's around about, 20 PSI.
Okay, what's it in horsepower? Because I think that's what most of us would understand. How much horsepower would that add?
We haven't actually tested it for horsepower yet.
Okay.
Again, this is still early days for this demonstrator vehicle. But if you look at torque, right, torque comes from, you know, putting in essentially fuel, right, that's energy and air because you're running stoichiometric. So it comes down to how much air you put in, which comes down to pressure, right? So torque is proportional to pressure. So this is capable of putting in an extra 30% pressure. which is a lot.
That's significant.
30% torque, correct.
Right.
Yes.
Now this is just, we're talking about an electric supercharger here, so we need more power. So where does that come from?
Again, this is part of what we call like a mild hybrid or 48-volt hybrid vehicle. So, if you look at engines of today, the best efficiency you get for an engine of today will not meet the 2025 regulations of a CO2 coming forward. So they need some level of energy recuperation. And, obviously a lot of OEMs have been building, hybrids, plug-in hybrids, which are quite expensive. They're having a harder time selling, especially when the price of gas is low. This comes in at a low cost, so it's like the cheaper alternative. But it still is capable of collecting quite a lot of regenerative energy. Now, once you collect the energy, what do you do with the energy? You could take the energy in through, and this vehicle has what we call a belt starter generator. So where your alternator normally is located, there's an electric machine that does both starting the engine, it does regeneration, recouping energy, it provides some torque assistance, and also it operates more efficiently than a standard alternator. So it's actually like a high-efficiency alternator. So there are a range of benefits for that. But again, coming down to your question, once you collect the energy, what do you do with it? You could put it back through that same motor. So if you've got, say, 2 kilowatts in of electrical power you want to use, you could put it through the motor. There's a little less than 2 kilowatts of the rear wheels because there's losses in the system. Mm-hmm. You put 2 kilowatts in electrically to electric supercharger, you'll get at least 12 kilowatts out. So it's reusing that electrical energy, which is the green part, right, and then using it in a way where it actually has the multiplication of power. So you're getting a lot of benefits there. You've got the fun to drive as well as being green in terms of lowering CO2. And once you have more torque there, you can look at doing lots of additional things to improve fuel economy, such as the downspeeding, running at lower RPM. Because when you run at low RPM, you need higher torque on reserve. This torque on demand is very important. The electric supercharger can spin up to 70,000 RPM in 0.25 of a second. So it's a very fast response. So you get the instant torque, which allows you to run at lower RPM, and it fills in the torque that's normally lost with the turbocharger at the lowest RPMs. So it provides a lot of advantages there.
So you get on the throttle, and it can spool up?
Very quickly. It's like, in terms of being controlled, it's just controlled through software. I mean, you tell it what speed to run at, it'll go to that speed. Unlike a turbocharger, I mean, obviously it's based on the energy of the gas going through, which varies, and you have wastegate controls and various things to help control it, but it's nowhere near as responsive as the electric supercharger.
So is the sequence that you're launching electrically, then the supercharger kicks in, and then the conventional turbo takes over? Is that how it rolls out, basically?
Yeah, more or less, yeah. I mean, obviously the driver still presses on the accelerator pedal. That's a torque demand in the system. So then normally the engine controller would control the turbocharger, and there's a delay getting up the torque. But in our case, obviously we see that the torque demand, we instantly spool up, we provide that instant torque, and then as the torque of the engine through the turbocharger starts to build up, we back off our system. So to reduce turbo lag, we only run for like 1 to 1.5 seconds of time.
But in the case of this vehicle, it's an internal combustion engine that is powering the vehicle. There's no electric machine that is driving the wheels.
Correct. That's right. Yeah.
So then you supplement that with the electric supercharger.
Yeah. It puts the additional. It makes the engine work better, I guess. You know, mm-hmm. It provides more boosting, makes it much more responsive, and as I mentioned, to get rid of turbo lag, only runs for a very very short time. So there's not much energy consumed at all. Mm-hmm. But if you want, you can also have it running at the same time as your main turbocharger. So you've got compound boosting. That's when you get a lot more torque out of the system. Mm-hmm. That gives you more sustained torque. So if you want to, climb a hill or overtake or whatever, it can provide the extra torque assistance.
So you say the electric supercharger is only operating on average about a second and a half?
If all you're trying to address is turbo lag. Mm-hmm. And a lot of cases, that's all you need, because you're driving along and you're just tipping the accelerator pedal and expect the car to take off. This thing spools up. It gets the pressure there, which gives you the torque. The engine's now running at higher load. There's now a lot of heat coming out of the exhaust. That makes your main turbo spin up much faster. So your main turbo is now running much better. And then this thing just backs off. It's not needed. So it's only cases when you want really high torque levels where you have them both running together at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So when you get on the throttle, it's more linear, not this lag than
correct. Yeah.
As a normal turbo yeah. is.
And there are a lot of things that OEMs do to reduce turbo lag, you know, with the vehicles, which are compromises, right? I mean, there's the torque converter on this vehicle. This one has a, you're talking in terms of K factor, it's like slip. It's got a K factor of 235 and a torque ratio of 2. I mean, obviously, you want the torque ratio to help, you know, the vehicle accelerate, but part of the purpose of the torque converter is when you tip in, the torque converter opens up, and then and that takes a little bit of time, which is another delay. Then the RPM builds up, and that gets the extra flow through the engine to make your main turbo kick in faster. Mm-hmm. With having electric supercharger, you don't have to open that torque converter, or you can have less slip in the torque converter, and that has a number of benefits. If you're not opening the torque converter as much, you're not having that lost efficiency in slip. Also means your engine speed is lower and your torque levels are high and you get very good efficiency from the engine. You're more in the sweet spot of the engine. So there's a lot of benefits on the torque converter side, and also if you can stay in the higher gears for longer too.
So you envision downsizing the engine then? Is that where you're going to get the...
Well, that's the trend in the industry, is to downsize. So, yeah, that'll continue going, you know, obviously to 2025 and beyond. So this is really a facilitator to help in the downsizing process, because turbos are great, but they still have some weaknesses. When coupled with electric supercharger, it makes a great combination. And then when coupled with the BSG, the belt starter generator, or any other, it could be a motor generator attached to your gearbox or differential, that also has a lot of synergies, because that can gets this free energy, which is great, because you've got a great way of using this energy with electric supercharger. The other issue with looking at simply a mild hybrid where you've got a battery pack, you've got your e-machine, which is both a motor and a generator to collect energy, is that if your battery pack is low on charge, you can't run that e-machine to provide any torque assistance. Or if it's cold, you're in a Michigan winter, right? You can't use the battery until it warms up. With our system, you just run that e-machine to generate like an alternator. It provides the power direct to the electric supercharger, and now you've still got this 24/7 fun to drive. Mm. And customers really expect that. They can't have something that works one day and then not the next. They want to make sure it's repeatable and reliable.
Okay, Matty, we've got a question here from Neil G. from Normal, Illinois, who says, what's the difference between an electric turbocharger and an electric supercharger?
A good question. Sometimes there's no difference. It's just the terminology, right? People, they like the word turbocharger, so they put the word electric on it. I guess Valeo's response is that, look at the origins of the word turbocharger. Turbocharger is two main things. It's a compressor wheel and it's a turbine, and it's using the energy from the exhaust and compressing air. Well, our electric supercharger does not have a turbine. It's simply a compressor wheel with an electric machine attached to it. That's why we call it electric supercharger. Some people still call machines like that electric turbochargers, just because the name's been around and people are familiar with it. But there are some variations out there where they have a electric machine which goes between a turbine and a compressor. So there is now, some...
We're looking under the hood of this vehicle and we saw where the electric supercharger is located. And it looks to me as though you didn't have to do a tremendous engine tear-up, that it was basically something that was pretty simple to, simple for me to look at and say simple to you, but so it isn't a major architectural change that would need to be done by the OEMs were they to use something like this?
Correct. I mean, obviously we're developing a product, but you're only successful if the OEMs buy it and gets out into production. Mm-hmm. And, obviously the development cost side of it is very important. The piece cost side of it is very important. So a lot of attention has been paid to get the cost down and make it easy to integrate. Mm-hmm. So this electric supercharger can be mounted anywhere in the air path. So it can be mounted right after your air filter, and you can have it before or after your low-pressure EGR. You could have it mounted after your main turbocharger and then before or after your high-pressure EGR. So it's very flexible where it can be. It can be mounted on the chassis, as is in this vehicle, or it can be mounted on engine. If you've got a normal turbocharger, you've got a lot of restrictions. You've got, there's an exhaust side and there's an air intake side, and that obviously limits where you can put it and makes the packaging more difficult. We only have to connect to the air side. The other aspect with turbochargers is they run to very high RPMs, hundreds of thousands of RPMs, We purposely limited ours to 70,000 RPM for a number of reasons. We still get away with more conventional type of ball bearings. We don't have an external oil line coming into our system, which again makes it easier to plumb into to the system, also lowers the cost. And by being at lower RPM, also we don't need exotic materials for our compressor blades and things like that. So it comes down to, yeah, being flexibility of packaging and keeping the cost low.
So how does it compare cost to cost? I mean, no wastegate, you know, flexible packaging, no oiling and the like. How does the cost compare to a regular turbo?
I can't talk about costs, but if you're looking at a electric supercharger, it's very similar to like an alternator. It's a rotating machine. It needs to go through a similar sort of assembly process, balancing and such. Mm-hmm. And Valeo is typically number one or two globally for alternator business. So there's a lot of synergies there. So we're bringing it down to almost like a commodity. So wow. It's going to be very, very competitive pricing for that.
Wow.
But we see it as being, again, working with turbochargers. We're not trying to compete with turbochargers because, again, they get their energy from the exhaust, mm-hmm. Which is ideal way of getting it. So, but there are applications where we have the electric supercharger on a naturally aspirated engine, and it's just used to assist the engine run more efficient combustion cycles. Hmm. So obviously you're very familiar with Atkinson cycle. It's used in a lot of hybrids. Well, there's sort of an extension to that called Miller cycle. So it'd be supporting Miller cycle type combustion.
And we should let everybody know, too, it's in production right now. Audi has introduced this right on the Q7 in Europe.
That's correct. It's the 2017 SQ7. It's a reasonable size SUV. It is a diesel engine. It's a 4-liter diesel engine, and it'll accelerate from zero, and it's European. It's 100 kilometers per hour, so 62.5 miles per hour in 4.8 seconds.
So that's pretty good.
You don't think of diesels as being sports cars. I mean, this has got good acceleration. It's still 31.8 miles per gallon over the NEDC cycle. Mm-hmm. So you're getting the fuel efficiency plus the fun to drive. Mm-hmm. That's quite a impressive vehicle.
Now, one of the interesting things on this vehicle that we have here in the studio, the MKZ, was when I was driving it, that when I was at freeway speeds and I lifted, the engine shut off.
Okay, yeah. Again, that's looking at the overall vehicle. So, again, it's like a mild hybrid that's enhanced by the electric supercharger. So, again, we have a belt-driven electric machine, which acts as an alternator, a generator or a motor. And it provides starting of the engine. So when you come to a complete stop, most people are now starting to see vehicles have their start-stop systems. Now, typically, you come to a stop, and then the engine turns off and then restarts. And they're using more typical, starter motors, a bit more ruggedized, because you're going from being, 30,000 starts to a couple hundred thousand starts for the life of the vehicle. But they're somewhat limited. Let's say you're coming down and you want to turn the engine off at speed, and then the engine speed's falling down. You cannot restart it until it falls in a certain speed range at the low RPM. So it doesn't really have what we call change of mind. With our system...
That's a technical term, right?
Yeah.
Change of mind.
Change of mind. So the customer wants to, decides to take his foot off the pedal and wants to shut the engine off, but then changes his mind, wants to accelerate again. Now, with a belt-driven systems, it's always connected to the engine. So, number one, it can restart it at any time. The other aspect is it accelerates the engine much faster than a starter motor. Now, part of the problem with what you see in engines when you start is that as the engine speed comes up, it passes through a resonance on the engine mounts. So there's a little bit of vibration there. The faster you pass through that, the less the vibration. Now, with these belt-driven systems, these BSGs, it spins up very quickly, reduces the NVH. Now, when you're looking at highway speeds, as we're doing what we call coasting or sailing. We're going along the road, we take a foot off the accelerator pedal. There's a short delay in case the driver changes his mind. Then we actually turn the engine off. So engine speed comes down. As soon as you tap the brake pedal or the accelerator pedal, it restarts it very quickly and then goes, it's actually a neutral gear at that point, and then it has to reconnect into drive. And it does it fairly smoothly. I mean, the system we have in the vehicle here is really for demonstration purposes. What we'd recommend for a production system is an electric fast-acting clutch in the mm-hmm. system rather than going through the automatic transmission, because there were some slight delays in the transmission changing gears.
Yeah. Hey, we've got some more questions here. In fact, we've got a phone call that they're holding, but let's get to one of the questions first. Jim wrote in to say, what kind of battery are you using, lead acid or lithium ion?
In our case, we're using an A123 8 amp hour lithium ion battery. So obviously, lithium ion has some advantages in terms of the both the power density and energy density.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I think most of the industry that's moving towards 48 volts is really looking at lithium ion. But there are some areas which where weight isn't important. You're looking at trucks, you know, Class 8 trucks, and they're looking at using lead acid.
No kidding.
Because of cost. And it's still got, you know, quite good energy density, but they're looking at the hotel loads. So when the vehicle comes to a stop, they can still run their AC or whatever in the vehicle overnight. But, yeah, for passenger vehicles and such, it's definitely lithium ion. There are some applications that have also looked at ultra caps as well.
Very interesting. Okay, we've got a phone call here. Carmen, let's bring that phoner in.
This is Clem Zorowski at Delmont, Pennsylvania. I remember about 10, 15 years ago, there was an outfit selling an electric supercharger for Harley-Davidson motorcycles. Is this the same company that did it for motorcycles? Thank you very much.
Okay, that was hard for us to hear, but one of the questions was Harley-Davidson did something along these lines?
I'm not familiar with what they've done, but now this is something totally different. But, I mean, the overall development really started, you know, going back to, like, the very late 90s, if you look at the initial development. It's gone through time, lots of revisions. This vehicle has a Generation 3.5 unit in there, and Generation 4 is currently in production with Audi on the SQ7. And we're currently working on Gen 4.5 and Gen 5 systems, again, addressing cost, packaging size and such. But I'm not familiar with the Harley one at all.
So this is basically, though, predicated on being able to have the 48-volt system. Is that correct? I mean, you have a 12-volt system in this car to do the headlights and the HVAC and so on and so forth. But in terms of electric supercharger, I mean, is it a practical thing to have it with anything other than a 48-volt system?
Yes. I mean, we do have a 12-volt version. We support up to 24. I mean, if you look at the Mazda iLoop type applications where they're using ultra caps, the voltage isn't fixed. It can go up and down. Mm. So we support those applications and then 48 volts and even the high voltage applications.
Higher than 48?
Well, at the moment, we don't see a real need for having the electric supercharger on hybrid applications. But if you look at hybrids, most hybrids have Atkinson cycle engines, which gives you the better efficiency. But there's still advantages in going to a millicycle or getting more performance out of a small size engine. So there's some benefits of electric supercharge even with hybrids. But again, because of the low price of gas and the higher cost of hybrids, it's not in high demand. I mean, it's an area that we see longer term in the future. But currently, we see the highest demand is for the 48-volt systems. I mean, if you look at electric supercharge, we have obviously a number of programs moving forward, Audi just being the first one. But the initial programs, if you try to just categorize it, it is for fun to drive. That's the main driver. Mm-hmm. So they're moving more to the 48 volts initially because that's the fun to drive. And then you look beyond that, the next use is really for simplification of your powertrain systems. If you look back historically, I mean, all the OEMs, particularly the big three here, you had your V8s. They were the high power ones. You had your V6s. They were the medium power. Then you had your i4s, which is your baseline. They were, baseline power. Now, the approach being taken by some OEMs is to have one size engine, one standard design, and going through different levels of boost to give you the higher power. So your premium engine will just have higher boost pressures. And then you've got your medium power and your lower power. Mm. And obviously, the electric supercharger helps facilitate that type of move.
You see, I mean, Audi is the first. Do you see the interest right now primarily Germans, or what's the mood here in the U.S. for adapting 48?
Well, if you're looking at 48 volts, obviously we started with the Germans. Obviously the Germans have high electrical load in the vehicle, and it's not just driven by like CO2. I mean, the electrical loads in vehicles is rising. There's more and more electrical equipment going on. There's a move now towards other components on the vehicle that provide benefits to the consumer, like in terms of body, like ride control, right? Like active suspension and such. I mean, there's a lot of new devices coming out that consume a high power. You just can't do that with a 12-volt board net or grid in the vehicle. So, and obviously the Germans were looking forward to what they see in the future. Their loads was fairly high. Once you pass about 300 amps with an alternator, you really got to look at coming to a higher voltage level. So that's one of the big drivers there. So they were the initial ones pushing it, right, and getting it started. But China has the biggest demand. compared to Europe. It's just, you know, they seem to be leapfrogging, you know, the technologies. They want to adopt the latest, and there's a lot of demand in China.
We've got a couple of questions here. One came from Warren, says, what about an aftermarket solution for vehicles that are already on the road? He goes on to add, I have a 1993 Ranger that uses a calendar to measure acceleration.
Sounds like the perfect application.
Yeah.
Obviously, within Valeo, we are looking at all options, right? But our main focus at the moment is to, you know, get out with the OEMs. And typically, you find that in the development process, it goes out to the OEMs first and comes in the aftermarket. But Valeo does have a fairly strong aftermarket area for, you know, for wipers and all sorts of products. So, I mean, it may come in the future. The problem, though, is that, you know, simply adding these things to vehicles, there's all the other things to consider, like the diagnostic side and, you know, the emissions side and things like that. So it's a bit of a nightmare there in terms of legislation to go through. So I'm not sure what's going to happen in that area.
But Steve B. wants to know, how much does the e-supercharger system weigh?
The electric supercharger, I mean, I work in metrics, so it's going to be, you know, around 2 kilograms or a bit less.
So
what's that?
So about four and a half pounds?
Yeah, maybe, yeah, more or less.
Nothing,
yeah.
Really.
Mm.
That's pretty,
yeah,
light.
I mean, if you look at the total system with the 48 volt, it goes up higher.
And because of the battery. That
the battery,
have.
Yeah. I mean, the battery is what you probably call the weak link in any sort of hybrid. I mean, in mild hybrids, it's probably half the cost of the system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but there's been a lot of advances made in batteries, and prices are coming down.
They are.
Yeah.
But if someone has a 48-volt system and they have your electric supercharger, presumably you can amortize the weight of the battery by using it for other applications. Is that so?
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the drivers for, yeah, again, for, you know, mild hybrids or any sort of hybrids, it's been CO2. It's, mm-hmm, to, you know, reduce the emissions. But there's a lot of other benefits there. Like I mentioned, the active body control, mm-hmm, other areas. I mean, customers aren't willing to pay for CO2 reductions, but they will pay for things that they feel is a benefit to them. And PTC heaters, I mean, defrosts for your windscreen, your seat heaters. You know, if it heats up 4 times faster, that's something the customers appreciate. So that's another major benefit of 48 volt systems.
Your heated seats will get hot faster,
much much faster.
Oh,
yeah,
I'm all for it.
Yeah, well, and then, you know, ice off your windows faster.
Yeah, much faster. You know, so there's a lot of different benefits there. I mean, things like the stop start systems out there that do save fuel, but then if you look at, you know, summer in Arizona or Texas or somewhere, it's too hot. Your AC runs, so you can see a move towards 48 volt AC compressors as well. That means you'll really start to get the true benefits from these systems.
So Audi has got it in the SQ7, as you mentioned.
Yes.
I've got to believe with you having this Lincoln development that there's going to be many more applications coming very quickly.
Yes, there are a number of applications coming out, including 12 volt, but the first ones, as I mentioned, are the 48 volt systems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 12 volt makes it, 12 volt, probably from what you're saying, not going to be around that long.
No.
12 volt e-supercharger.
No, we still see 12 volts as being there for at least the reasonable long term, right? I mean, mm-hmm, if you had a clean sheet of paper and you had to start from scratch, you would choose 48 volts. Mm-hmm. You know, you wouldn't go for 12 volts. But there's just so much legacy stuff out there. I mean, is it worth the development cost to change everything from 12 to 48 volts? And the answer is, you know, likely no, right? But any new devices or higher power-consuming devices, yes, it makes good sense to convert to 48 volt. Again, if you get the current down and your voltage up, you reduce your losses significantly. You get better efficiency. So there'll be a move with all the high-power devices, like electric power steering and other devices, to move those to 48 volt. And then you still have a 12-volt board net in the vehicle. So there'll be two systems in place. And you'll likely even see it with hybrids. You'll find there's going to likely be three systems in place, because there's still advantages with having 48-volt systems, even with a full hybrid. I mean, a lot of full hybrids now will start the engine using the big E machine. But in order to do that, just like start a machine from, you know, like stall conditions, it increases the size and the cost of your inverter, your power electronics. If you can start it with a 48-volt system, you can actually get some cost out in some places. So we think 48 volts is definitely coming, but we still see 12 volts as staying, but for the low power consuming devices.
So it'd be a dual system.
Correct. Yeah.
When was, I know it varied regionally around the world, but when did the industry move from 6 volt to 12 volt? I want to say in the United States it was sometime in the 1950s. but I don't.
Predates me, sorry. I got a few gray hairs here.
But I guess the point is, at one point, the industry did make a wholesale change, and I'm sure that was stretched over years. Yeah. But nonetheless, I think 48 volts sounds like the way to go in the future.
It could. I mean, if you find enough companies are willing to convert their products, you know, but it's going to be very hard initially because of it's the cost.
Sure. Right?
So those seat heaters need to be rewired. They're not the normal. Those wires will burn out otherwise,
yeah.
Right?
That's right. And like your HVAC fan, any sort of fan motors and that, you can reduce the power consumption there a lot. So there's a lot of opportunity to lower the energy consumption in the vehicle by going to 48 volts.
Very interesting. Matty Vint, thanks so much for coming on Autoline After Hours and especially for bringing your car along with you.
No, thanks for having us. It's my pleasure to be here and meeting you all, and I hope it was some use to your audience as well.
I think the audience is fascinated by this. I know I am. So thanks again. Really appreciate it. Okay. Sit tight just for the moment because we're going to take a quick commercial break. We got a lot more to talk about when we come back.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back, and we got to let everybody know. Matty Vint is gone, but David Welch is here.
I'm in the house.
You are. Good to have you here again.
Good to be back.
Okay, but this is the part of the show where we got to go to Dr. Data.
Okay, so...
Not Commander Data?
Dr. Data.
All right, Carmen, please bring up the first number. So...
Nothing kills it like Star Trek humor.
Yeah.
All right. So we have two numbers here: 21% down, 30% up.
And okay. A traffic light. What's the traffic light?
The traffic light. So
there's a reason.
There's a reason for the traffic light. So what might this be?
With a traffic light, I'm going to guess fewer red light cameras and an increase in rear end collisions.
Wow, you're very, very close.
Really?
You're very close. Okay, so let's bring up the next one. Okay, so they ran a study to see what happens when they have the red light cameras versus when they don't have the red light cameras, right? So they had them and then they took them off. So you can see that the number of fatalities went down by 21% when they were using
the cameras,
right? So the next one...
When Big Brother's watching, people pay more
attention. Exactly. And then what happens when Big Brother's not watching? Next, 30% increase in fatalities. So it begs the question that, you know, people are saying, well, gee whiz, I don't necessarily want to be watched by these cameras, and isn't this a violation of civil liberties and so on and so forth? But, I mean, it's a tremendous delta.
Now, presumably, there had to be warning signs that said... red light cameras ahead so that people were worried and they paid more attention. Yeah, and then they took the signs away and everybody went sailing into the intersection.
Like if you drive around Scottsdale and places like that, I mean, there are signs as you're going into communities that say, you know, red light cameras are in use. So, I mean, yeah, there's an awareness.
Can you see those too? Like, I think in the places I've seen them, there's an extra rack or something above the light.
But there's so much stuff these days anyway, cameras and whatnot. I mean, not just red light cameras.
I'm wondering how the people knew as well, and if.
I know in a lot of communities, like Gary is saying, they had to have a sign that said,
"Hey." There's a big sign that says, "If you run this."
It's probably not like a big arrow though, going, you know, red light camera here.
Yeah.
But I guess you
have to make a sudden decision though, like, oh, cameras off. I can run the light or whatever, right?
Yeah, I mean, but isn't it interesting that because you know you're watched, you know, your driving behavior changes so significantly, and in this case, so unfortunately.
Well, think about when you're driving and there's a cop just coasting along the highway, and you were...
Everybody hits the brakes. Everyone slows down.
Until they drive better.
You're doing 72 in a 70-mile-an-hour zone, and you see a cop, and I don't know about you guys, but I kind of slowed down to, like, 65, right? Like, I don't want anything...
Idiot! That's not what you do!
You know, I'm a little...
John speeds up.
I'm a little paranoid.
No, I'm with you 100%. Same reaction.
I don't go down to 50 in a 70-mile-an-hour zone, but like 65. Well, everyone else is doing it, too.
I slow down from 80 to about 74.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, number one, the
speedometers are not that accurate. They're off. So when you think you're going 80, you're probably going 77.
Anyway. I've always wondered if you have your nav system, like Waze has your speed, it's always like 3 mph off of what my car's odometer says.
And that's faster, not just faster or slower, doesn't it?
Waze says I'm going slower. And that's not just my own car. It's been with test cars I've been in as well. Hmm. So I can't figure out if it's something with their software. It's
latency in the signal getting back and forth.
Something.
Or they're predicting, right? Maybe it's predicting where I'm going to be and adding speed on or something. But it's like two or three off.
Interesting. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, I know depending on the model and definitely from manufacturer to manufacturer, there's a wide discrepancy in what the speedometer says and what you're actually doing. In fact, I've seen the difference in a lot of cars where, like, you have a head-up display that's got the electronic readout of how fast you're going, and then you look at the gauge, the speedometer in the instrument cluster, and the electronic stuff always looks slower, or I should maybe state it the other way. Your needle on the speedometer always reads higher than what I see with the electronic readout with a HUD.
I'm not sure that'll help you if you go to fight a speeding ticket.
No, it won't. It won't. So I do slow down if I'm going 80. But
I went and fought a ticket once, and this is my younger day when I used to get many tickets, and the officer or the magistrate said, "You've had 7 tickets in 4 years. How do you explain this?" I said, "Perhaps I'm driving more."
How'd that work out for you?
That's good. So you mentioned before you drove the Kia Cadenza.
Yeah, and the week before that, I drove the Hyundai Genesis G90. Mm-hmm. And, boy, I got to tell you so Hyundai, of course, owns Kia, but there's a wall between the two, and they...
It's a manufacturing combine, basically.
Basically. But, I mean, it's very interesting to me, and I think, I want to know what you guys think about this, but, you know, you see Hyundai just basically saying, you know what? We're going to go in the luxury market. We're going to go in a big way. We're going to have 6 vehicles that have the Genesis badge by 2021. We're going to, you know, provide the same sort of luxury that anyone expects from a German car or from a Japanese car. I mean, they were very, very emphatic that they were looking at Lexus and saying, you know, it took them 10 years, and we're going to try to do it somewhat faster. But we realize it's going to take a long time to do this. And... You know, so the Cadenza, which is now they have the Kia has the K900 higher up, and then the Cadenza is sort of the Buick of their lineup. But I mean, very nicely executed. You know, it seems to me that it could be competitive with a vehicle like the MKZ, not that MKZ, but an MKZ. And you know, and again, if you look at the numbers that they're selling Cadenzas in the United States, it isn't that many. Now, this is the second generation of the vehicle. They've had the vehicle in market for 3 years, a new car, okay? Not a refresh. It's a new car. Mm-hmm. So, you know, is this a company that is really going to be on the move in terms of trying to take more and more market in the U.S.? And you think about Kia was, you know, in J.D. Power IQS this year, it was the number one brand, which is the first mass market car in 27 years to take the number one spot. The one before that was Toyota, and they've been measuring it only for 30 years, right? So, I mean, what a remarkable change.
No, that's incredible. It really is. And they beat out Porsche. Yeah. Kia did.
Yeah, everybody. So,
right. But, I mean, Porsche had always been at the top of that list. That's why I'm mentioning them. But, no, it's interesting because I just got back literally a little over an hour ago from the U.S. launch for the Volvo S90, you know, and this is their flagship sedan. This is their Bigfoot forward. And I had not driven the Genesis G90, mm-hmm. but several of my colleagues who were on this trip had driven it, and they were like, that Hyundai's better than this Volvo. So to your point, yeah,
they're
Hyundai
cool
and Kia,
stuff.
they're really good.
It's going to be a question of how quickly they can get people to look at the brand and pay big money for those cars. So look, there's something else that's been going on with the Koreans for, and this was happening more in the 2000s. But remember, they were going upscale. The cars were getting bigger, and they were starting to make, you know, Genesis, not as a separate brand, but Genesis kind of stuff. And one of the, in a way, they had to, because at least during the 2000s, the way the union contracts in Korea worked, they would negotiate wages one year and benefits the next. And their costs kept going up. So it was no longer the cheap, dirt cheap place to produce. So what do you do when your costs go up? And, you know, unless you can find a way to push them back down, you have to sell more expensive cars. And that's why they were, you know, Hyundai, over the course of that decade, went from being, you know, the cheap version of anything to kind of priced right on Honda and Toyotas, or pretty close to it. And now they're pushing into the luxury market. And look, that's where the money is. When GM said they were spending $12 billion on Cadillac over the next like 5-6 years, President Dan Ammen said that, you know, what luxury is what, I think he said it was 12% of global sales and 50% of profits, or some really big number like that.
Right.
So everybody wants a piece of that. If you only sell a few, you still make good money. If you sell enough to cover the cost of right. everything you yeah. had to invest.
Well, you know, this sort of raises a question. You know, you mentioning Cadillac, and you know, the thing that sort of occurs to me is that, you know, right now, with the exception primarily of Escalade, that Cadillac sales are struggling here. And part of that is arguably pricing, because I think we've all driven the ATS and the CTS. I mean, and they're really fine cars. I mean, but they're priced like a BMW or priced like a Mercedes. And, you know, I talked to Dave Zuchkowski, which we had on the show.
From Hyundai.
And so he's you know, the number one guy. So Genesis is under him. And, you know, and he had, you know, they have a real awareness in terms of what's going on in terms of companies like Cadillac in terms of pricing. And you got to believe that when this Genesis pricing is announced, that it's going to be, you know, value, right? And therefore, it will become more appealing to someone who's in that segment. And then as they go forward, you know, they're going to have, you know, they'll be bringing out a crossover and a sports sedan and so on and so forth. So, I mean, what does that do to the comeback of Lincoln? What does that do to the sales of Cadillacs when you suddenly have this new player in the mix?
Makes it harder.
Yeah. I mean, the market's just so crowded, you know.
Don't forget Alfa Romeo.
Coming too.
Look, it's a luxury car with a, you know, with a snooty brand and, you know, good design, and it's going to have performance. And, you know, I've thought for in a lot of marketing, people will tell you this, you know, it's not always, if someone's buying a 3 Series, it's, you know, they're not always shopping an A4 and a C-Class. They're thinking, I've got $40,000 to spend. What can I get? And they'll look at SUVs. They'll look at a bunch of stuff that you wouldn't think is like for like. It's, this is how much money I can spend on a car. What can I get for it? So I think that will affect Cadillac and Lincoln to a certain degree. Now, the other question is, how much cross-shopping is there between those brands? And, you know, that's a little tough. I mean, there are a lot of domestic loyal customers who still buy Cadillacs and still buy Lincolns. But for the person who's generally out there, it's going to be more competition to get that volume.
Oh, yeah. And then you got all these new startups, you know, the Faraday Futures and the Leicos and everybody else coming in. That luxury segment.
Oh, look at the luxury brands
really
this
under
year.
Pressure.
BMW's down, what, 8% this year? And
in the U.S. market.
Yeah, in the U.S. market, I mean. You know, it hasn't been great. Last year was. Frankly, I don't think there are fewer luxury buyers. I think the sales race last year, there was a lot of pulling ahead going on with sales and getting people to buy cars in 2015, and they got their car now. They don't need to go buy a new BMW or Mercedes or
Lexus.
That's
true.
Well, they mentioned that the last time there was a new luxury brand was Tesla. Now, I remember the last time you were on the show, you had interesting things to say about Mr. Musk, who had a big announcement this week about the new batteries for the Tesla. So what do you make of that?
Well, we had an interesting day because...
Well, hold on. For those who didn't hear, what was the announcement?
Well,
I assume that everybody knows everything.
Very true. So
Tesla, everybody reads this stuff.
So they're going to be offering a 100-kilowatt-hour battery pack. Now, their highest before had been a 90-kilowatt-hour battery pack, and this is something that you can get for your Model S or your Model X. And so basically what this is going to do is, so for the Model S, it'll extend the range to 315 miles before you need a charge, which
315,
is
315,
315.
It's at 270. This is for the ludicrous mode. It was at 270 before. And the 0 to 60 time goes from 2.8 to 2.5 seconds.
Yowza.
Right.
That's good.
And they're saying that the LaFerrari and the Porsche 918 Spyder are the only two cars that were faster. And they also pointed out that both of those cars had very limited space, and as we know, the Model S can, you know, take luggage and people and animals and God knows what else in it.
You can have the rear-looking back seat, too.
That's true, and even more people. So basically, Tesla customers who have ordered a P90D Ludicrous but not taken delivery can upgrade the 100-kilowatt-hour pack for $10,000. So, you know...
So $1,000 per kilowatt hour.
Existing customers who have cars who want to upgrade can upgrade for $20,000. And the part of the rationalization for the extra money is as they're used, 90 kilowatt hour pack will have to be recycled. So it's a recycling fee.
I wonder if there are other parts in there, too, that you need to upgrade.
Well, they were saying something about the cooling had to be modified
right.
for that. And but I thought that in the announcement, which, of course, was, that Elon posted it in his blog, this is just made my head explode when I read it. While the P100D Ludicrous is obviously an expensive vehicle, we want to emphasize that every sale helps pay for the smaller and much more affordable Tesla Model 3 that is in development. Without customers willing to buy the expensive Model S and X, we would be unable to fund the smaller, more affordable Model 3 development. So my question is, how many people who want to go from 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds say to themselves, you know, but that guy down the street really might want a Model 3 someday. So I think I got to do my part. I got to pony up for the new battery.
I got to do my part.
Yeah, that's brand. I think, you know, I mean, when they can get that attention from knocking, would you say 2/10 of a second off of there?
3/10.
I mean, if the Mustang knocked 3/10 of a second off at 0 to 60, would there have been that much press?
Would the analyst community care?
Yeah. Well, I think this was interesting. The stock went up 2.5%. That day after Elon tweeted that there was product news coming. Now, once that product news, this battery upgrade, came out, all of that it gained that day was almost always given back, and it ended up being like up 0.8% that day.
But somebody made money on the rise.
Yeah, right.
Well, sure.
And somebody made the money on the drop.
But it's that, you know, Elon is a master at playing with...
Well, look at the upsell on this, or the upcharge. What's his battery cost now? $240 per kilowatt hour, something like that. So he's making them for $240 and selling it for $1,000. That's pretty good.
That's helping fund the Model 3.
And he didn't even mention the polar bears.
But look, the interesting thing about this that he said on the conference call is getting that extra 10 kilowatt hours and getting the extra performance in terms of range and speed that he talked about he said, while it may only be, you know, 10 kW over the 90, it's like, in terms of degree of difficulty, it was like a 50% leap. He said they're pushing the theoretical boundaries of what they can do at the moment with that battery technology.
Right. Well, he was saying that it was because it's basically the same size. And
right.
So he's saying that in order to go beyond that, they would need to have a new form factor for that battery. What do you think the reaction was at places like General Motors, who, you know, will be going with the Bolt, that suddenly here's this guy now, he's saying, 350-mile range. You know, and GM's talking about 200. And, you know, here's this guy who's... just trumped it again.
Well, when GM says 200, I think it's more like 240. And who knows what else they've got in their pocket.
The Bolt is going to be, 40% the price, 30%, like, you know, a third the price of a Model S. And we're also, by the way, we're talking about the Model S P100D Ludicrous version. which is, that's a well over $100,000 car.
Right.
And the Bolt is much cheaper. But it does, they haven't said 300 miles of range for the Model 3. They really haven't told us what it's going to be yet. But I doubt it'll be that high just because you're talking about a smaller battery within the car. Unless, look, in the next 18 months or however long it takes them to get that car out, they really get some breakthroughs or some advancement in power density and so forth.
So you're being brought along here because now you're saying it may be out in 18 months, the Model 3. You got that?
Yeah.
Sure, write that down.
I said, or whatever, however long it takes. Because we don't know. I mean, Elon sort of himself jokes about missing deadlines on product all
That's
the
right.
time and being late for press conferences and everything.
Okay, another thing that you had on the list here, Gary, Delphi and Mobileye.
Yeah, so here you have two automotive suppliers. Well, okay, so Delphi, clearly automotive supplier, longtime automotive supplier, and then Mobileye, a sort of, how would we call this?
Startup.
New technology automotive supplier.
Sure, there you go, yeah.
That, and I find this to be very interesting. So you have this announcement that they're going to come out with, they're going to co-develop an autonomous drive system that they will then sell to OEMs as a package. And so this will include your radar and your camera system and the logic and so on and so forth. And, you know, and you think about it, I mean, almost any system on a car today is built by a supplier and not by the OEM. So, you know, here we have this situation where, you know, a longtime automotive supplier who knows how to make automotive grade things and knows what the reliability and so on needs to be. And then you have this new tech supplier that, you know, both coming together and says, okay, we'll have this package. So the question that I sort of have is that, remember when Sergio Marchionne was saying that basically autonomous systems are going to basically be commodities because the consumer won't know the difference, right? I mean, it's going to operate the same way, presumably. And therefore, he didn't see much point in spending a lot of time, effort, money.
Well, this is the guy, right, who says, I don't have the capital, and I got this big debt load, and everybody should merge together. Because
But if these guys come out and they basically have this package, I mean, I think he's validated.
He could be, except that, you know, he also talks about engines being commoditized, and I don't see him getting rid of them anytime soon.
Well, he's validated in that one claim that this could be commoditized.
Right.
This actually flies in the face of his whole talk about merging, because now you have two suppliers who are not only going to jointly develop and sell a system that anyone can use. Look, this was really good news for Subaru and Mazda, right? Because they don't have megabucks like GM and Google and BMW and Mercedes to develop these big expensive systems. But if they can really put out this system that's, you know, more, it was more camera and radar than LIDAR based. So it's a cheaper
right.
system, and they think they can get it to market faster by working together. This says that, actually, you don't need to merge every car company up to have tomorrow's technology.
Could be right.
For battery, maybe you do, but there are joint ventures on battery, and suppliers work on batteries. For fuel cells, GM works with Honda. You know, there are partnerships all over the industry that you can have without merging up. You know, the reason I think this, to a degree, flies in the face of what Sergio was saying is that there are ways to do it without merging, and automotive, you know, as we know, automotive mergers haven't worked. And really, let's face it, they want somebody else to come in and take care of a lot of their problems.
Just buy them out, right.
And
But I think what Gary's getting back is it's a make-buy decision. Is this critical that I, the automaker, have to develop this in-house? Or should I just go buy it from the suppliers?
Mm-hmm.
Ford and BMW have already put their stake down. They believe it's critical that they develop their own system. And interestingly enough, BMW has formed a consortium that includes Mobileye and Intel, by the way. And Ford has come out and said, no. We think we got an advantage here, a competitive advantage. And I remember talking to this woman that I know that works out in Silicon Valley with Electrabit, which was bought by Continental, which, by the way, is trying to put together another consortium yet, who said, where we're going to in the future is, of course, autonomy is going to be something that's going to be marketable. And the argument or the bragging rights in the future are not going to be that my car has more horsepower than yours. It's that my car is more autonomous than yours. And I do see where in certain situations, we've talked about this before, you know, you go to a tailgate party at a football game and the guy wants to, you know, tell you where to go park. Well, does your autonomous car know how to follow? Well, maybe Ford and BMWs will, and maybe this Delphi Mobileye will not. So I think it's going to be fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you take it out to its inevitable conclusion, he's right. You know, I mean, if cars completely are automated and all you do is sit there and read the paper, then at some point it becomes a commodity. Hmm. But to me, that's so far out. Yeah. That there's going to be room in the middle for what you're talking about, and they're not going to all operate the same, and they're not going to have the same features.
And for the next whatever it is, let's say it's 15 to 20 years, here's a case where I think first mover advantage could be really big, because if you have a luxury car that for $5,000 has autonomous drive, even if it's an M5, and the owner knows that whenever driving gets boring, he's on the highway, stop-and-go traffic, they can just let the car do it, and only one other brand or no other brands have it, for that 6 months or 12 months where you're really good at it, that's a big sales advantage and probably a big profit center as a high-priced option. And as you get that real-world experience of working with your customers and analyzing the cars, you can push the next one and the next one. Now, it'll get to the inevitable conclusion where it's a commodity, but how long is that? And we don't know, but... Look, Tesla had this system that was beta tested and doing just great for months until somebody died. And now they've got to go back and, keep working with the system and make sure that doesn't happen again. But do they have an advantage here in the sense that it's a core part of their brand that they were the first ones out there with great technology? I would argue that's kind of part of all of Tesla's DNA, is that they are first to do things that are really cool, and a lot of the things they do are things that the big companies either said couldn't be done or just won't do because you can't make a profit doing it. Mm-hmm. And they just have this daring do about them because they beta test autonomous drive and they've got electric cars that go to 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds, and it's just all part of their brand now. And it works really well for them. They just don't make any money.
Well, somebody just announced today they've already, I think it was today or maybe yesterday, they just launched an autonomous car service in Singapore.
Yeah.
And I know Delphi is working on it, but this was somebody who beat them to the punch.
Newtonomy.
Yeah, I've never heard of them.
It's a spinoff from MIT. And there's a certain section in Singapore where they're operating these. So you got to do something with those Mitsubishi electric cars. And so that's one of the things they're doing with them. And
was it IMEVs?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And
I know an owner of one. So I know the guy.
The one in the world?
And they're also using Renault Zoes, so both electric vehicles that they're doing this. And so apparently this is one of those deals where people got invited to download the app on their phone, and they could order one of these cars. Now, they were having Newtonomy engineers ride along with them, but, I mean, it was completely autonomous. And so this is on city streets. It's not in some.
So that's got to be the first in the world.
They
right?
said it's the first in the world. Yeah,
and but same isn't Volvo in Pittsburgh or something?
It's going to be. They're going to do they made that announcement that they're going to do they're going to do the Uber thing.
Right.
And it's going to be like later in the month, they said. And so these guys basically
later in the month? This month.
I thought it was this month. Yeah.
Okay.
And
Singapore is a good place to do it. To try it because it's one of those super congested mega cities.
Right, and it's not very big, so you can map the hell out of the place and have everything. Even though I know they're not going to go all over the city, they're on very specific routes, and I know that's what Delphi is going to do next year there.
So according to CEO and co-founder of Newtonomy, Carl Ingemeng, I can't pronounce his name, Newtonomy's first-in-the-world public trial is a direct reflection of the level of maturity we have achieved with our autonomous vehicle software system. The trial represents an extraordinary opportunity to collect feedback from riders in real-world sitting, and this feedback will give Newtonomy a unique advantage as we work toward deployment of a self-driving vehicle fleet in 2018.
Yowza.
Well, and then the Delphi announcement with Mobileye was 2019 that they would have it. So, I mean, this is really coming
quickly. Delphi, I thought, was starting next year, and I think they're using Audis, and then they want a purpose-built car by 2019, and no driver, because they're starting same thing with a human being behind the wheel, so nobody gets too worried.
2019 seems to be the time period when everyone is going to have some kind of autonomous car out there for retail or for use with a rideshare, ride-hailing service, or something like that.
Yeah, well, I don't think the cars will be available for retail. And then BMW and Ford are talking more like 2021,
Right. I think
retail sales, where you any of us can go buy one, we're probably talking somewhere after 2025.
I agree, but I think you'll see autonomous, you know, semi-autonomous options that have pretty good capability by 18 or 19. Mm-hmm. Cadillac's already going to have their option, but they're still saying you need your hands somewhere around the wheel. You can kind of drive like this.
Yeah, I don't get it. To me, that's the dumbest thing. Here's a car that can steer itself, but you better keep your hands on the steering wheel. What's the advantage?
It's for the 35 to 44-year-old air drumming market.
You might have nailed it. That might be it. Hey, we're coming up to the end here, but we got three really quick questions. Roll Tide from the audience wrote in to say, why was the Bolt ordering and production pushed back a couple of months? I hadn't heard that
it was either.
No.
Okay. And then Wright Knight wrote in because last week we were talking about mid-engine vets and what they could do with the Corvette brand and take it. And he says, no Corvette SUVs, and this is all cap, for all that is holy. So I just wanted to squeeze a couple of comments and questions in from the audience before we wrap up.
Isn't it the same people, though, that basically were saying that there'd be no Porsche SUV? How'd that work out for them?
Yeah. Porsche's laughing all the way to
tonight. But GM doesn't need to make a Corvette SUV because they can sell super expensive SUVs with Cadillac and GMC, for that matter. They have brands that do that and do that quite well. Cadillac has a lot of problems, but selling Escalades, not one
right.
of them.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but just think of a really fast one, though.
You could do a V-Series Escalade if you wanted.
This is a lot of mass to move.
Right.
Hey, they had Trailblazer SS that was pretty fast.
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, if you remember before that, they had the Cyclone and what was the other one?
Yeah, the based on the midsize truck.
Yeah, it was based on like a Jimmy and Typhoon.
Yeah.
And that thing was wicked fast, mm-hmm. and it was all-wheel drive.
So what, the Durango, what's the performance
SRT.
Version? Yeah, that's right. It's an SRT. That's a blast to drive, mm-hmm. and it goes like a scalded dog. That's an awesome SUV to drive.
Well, there's some good ones there. But anyway, time to wrap it up, guys. So, Dave Zoya, thanks so much for stopping by.
Tom.
Really appreciate having you here. David Welch, great to have you back as always.
Always great to be back.
Cool. And Gary, we'll keep on doing this.
Yeah, next week maybe.
Okay. Sounds like a plan. Thanks, everybody, for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.